DW WorldLink with Neil King.
Welcome to the programme. Following one of the most momentous and at the same time inconclusive Brexit weeks since the 2016 referendum, we take you to Northern Ireland to find out just how worried the locals of Derry are about a possible return of the Troubles in the event of a hard border. We also meet the English shop owner in Berlin who simply had enough of all things Brexit and is closing down after years of good business.
Oh, the form filling, wondering if some items won't be allowed in, which is very possible. It just will be completely different, and because it's completely different, I have no idea. Comes a point when you go, I really don't want to be doing that. Mm. And I wouldn't feel confident either.
That and more coming up on WorldLink. You're listening to DW's WorldLink with me, Neil King.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move. OK, you may say that, but you should hear Jean-Claude Juncker's voice as a result of our conversation.
British Prime Minister Theresa May came, croaked and lost another crucial Brexit vote in the House of Commons this week, following a last-ditch attempt to secure concessions from EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. But let's take this step by step. On Tuesday, shortly after that croaky performance you just heard, May's Brexit deal, a slight variation of the one already defeated in January, was voted down again by a large margin. A day later, a slim majority voted against a hard no-deal Brexit. And yet another day later, a robust majority of MPs voted in favour of an extension of the Brexit deadline, originally scheduled for March 29th. Any delay requires the unanimous approval of all EU member states that are convening for an EU summit in Brussels on the 21st of March. If the Prime Minister is able to get MPs to sign off on her deal in a third crunch vote before the summit, she will most likely ask the EU to delay Brexit until the 30th of June. If she fails a third time in the Commons, she may ask for a longer extension. But if the EU doesn't grant this, it's still technically possible for Britain to crash out of the EU without a deal at the end of this month. Either way, the main stumbling block in the Brexit negotiations has been the so-called backstop, or the issue of how to deal with the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland once the UK leaves the EU. Some fear a hard border could threaten a hard-won peace, citing recent attacks in the Northern Irish city of Derry. Local tour guide Paul Doherty knows the horror of conflict too well, having lost his father in one of the most notorious events of the Troubles, the bloody Sunday carnage of 1972. Jennifer Collins and Louise Osborne joined one of Paul's guided tours through Derry to get his take on the Troubles, Brexit and the future.
Emotional speech, but we will not stand idly by and watch the North.
It's a blustery day, and a stocky, jovial man in his 50s wearing a black jacket is standing in front of a large mural. Painted on the side of a building, it shows a young boy wearing a gas mask and holding a petrol bomb.
So that wall has been maintained over the years.
Local tour guide Paul Doherty is explaining the recent history of the Bogside, a mainly Catholic neighbourhood on the edge of the city of Derry in Northern Ireland. Standing around him, a group of US and Scottish tourists snap photos of the mural. Beside them is a wall adorned with the words, "You are now entering free Derry."
The army bases, the harassment, the daily brutality of the British army, nearly daily shooting attacks and bomb attacks and whatever else, arrests and your neighbours being dragged from their homes and stuff like that. You know, so certainly that's all changed as well. So it was really like a war zone here as well.
That was more than 20 years ago, during the Troubles, a 30-year conflict that killed more than 3,600 people. At that time, Londonderry, as it's known officially in the United Kingdom, although it's called Derry by most people who live there, was a Catholic republic and stronghold, plagued by violence.
Folks, meet the local lunatic. The Lord Mayor. Luke Coyle, the unofficial Lord Mayor of the city.
As Paul moves between joking with passing neighbours and talking about the Bogside's history, you could be mistaken for thinking it's all a distant memory. But in recent months, Brexit and the possibility of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland is flaring tensions in the north. As is uncertainty over the proposed solution, the backstop, which is an insurance policy that would kick in the event of the UK not finding a sufficient trade deal with the EU. It would effectively keep Northern Ireland aligned with the rest of the single market to avoid the need for customs checks, and with it, the hard border. But with no distinct timeline on when the backstop would come to an end, it's hated by Brexiteers and Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, and it's become the major hurdle in negotiations. The majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to remain in the EU. And polls indicate that a majority there also support the backstop. For someone like Paul, who identifies as Irish and would like a united Ireland reached by democratic means, Brexit and the possibility of a hard border are a disaster.
No one knows what's going to be delivered. People have ideas about the backstop and how that's going to pan out. If there is no agreement, essentially we're living in two different jurisdictions. We're living in the north of Ireland, which is no longer part of the European Union, and we're living very near the border, which there is part of the European Union. So I don't know legally and how people will move freely. I don't know. I'm not sure if it will develop. So, see, folks, I told you about him, didn't I, really? His dad was a big...
The tour passes a mural of a priest waving a white handkerchief. Four men behind him carry the lifeless body of 17-year-old Jackie Juddy, one of the victims of Bloody Sunday. That was the day British soldiers shot 28 unarmed civilians, killing 14 of them, during a protest for Catholic civil rights.
Lying at the end of this block of flats, there's another man at least very close to being dead. There's one... There are two others up there.
It was carried up here by four men, led by the priest with a white handkerchief. So the most poignant image of Bloody Sunday was here.
Paul brings the group to a grey stone memorial listing the names of the victims. It's just in front of a row of houses. This is where Paul's 31-year-old father, Patrick, was shot dead as he crouched in front of a low wall.
So my mum then had a... God rest her. She had to go then to the hospital and identify my dad's body in the morgue. And then she had to come home and tell the children that my dad was dead, you know. So I remember, not clearly, but I remember her words, actually. She addressed my sister Karen and says, your dad's dead, you know.
It was a watershed moment in the history of the Troubles, which started in 1968 and pitted mainly Catholic Republicans and Nationalists who wanted an end to British rule and to achieve a united Ireland against mainly Protestant Unionists who wanted to remain with the United Kingdom. It increased Catholic hostility to the British Army and state and worsened the conflict by prompting people to join groups like the IRA. Paul says he does the tour because he doesn't want people to forget what happened here. But dissident dissatisfaction has not completely disappeared.
Why did they disobey the order? Do not conduct a running battle down Roswell.
A group of young men mill outside a shop. Above the door flies the green, white and orange flag of the Republic of Ireland. And on the gable, there is a mural of two masked paramilitaries. One holds a rifle, the other a rocket launcher. Above them it reads, Unfinished Revolution. Dissident Republicans, Paul says. But he doesn't seem too concerned by their presence.
Our opinion is it's over, basically. There's no need to do this anymore. People will always be, there'll always be dissidents, there'll always be people who are disaffected, and there'll always be people who will disagree. But as you can see, a lot of them are young boys, young people as well. So, I mean, that's, people are sort of impressionable as well at that age, you know, so... Which we all were, you know. So
such groups reject the peace process in Northern Ireland and the signing of the 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement that ended the Troubles. Just last year, in July 2018, the dissident Republican group, the New IRA, was accused of orchestrating sectarian riots in Derry during the Unionist marching season. They threw petrol bombs at a Protestant housing estate and the police. The group is also believed to be behind a car bomb that went off in Derry city centre in January. Nobody was injured, but a group of teenagers had passed by moments earlier.
Had they been caught in that explosion and killed, you know, it would have been a different story here today as well. There would have been a lot of anger about the bomb alone, but a lot of anger if it had been realised that people had been killed. We've come out of that, and we've come out of the conflict as well. So it's just sort of annoying, and it's dragging people into the past. But my fear is that of a reckless sort of bomb, it might go off and maybe kill people.
Still, despite the recent incidents, Paul doesn't believe a hard border would lead to a return to the Troubles. Years of peace and stability have made paramilitary groups a less attractive option.
And they don't attract. They attract a very small number of young people, and maybe not so young people as well. And there's no willingness to to join up these groups. There's no, the young people are seeing past that, to be honest, you know.
Dominic Bryan, who specialises in political anthropology in Northern Ireland at Queen's University in Belfast, agrees with Paul's assessment. He says Northern Irish society is dramatically different to 50 years ago when Catholics faced rampant discrimination.
We have a Catholic community that is well integrated into the civil service, the police, the judiciary, all of those areas of life. So the conditions in which the Troubles took place before are not present now.
Bryan believes that Brexit hasn't had any great impact on paramilitary and dissident activity in Northern Ireland so far. Dissidents have continued to inflict violence in the 20 years since the peace agreement, but much of that, he says, has been related to organised crime, turf wars, punishment and vigilante attacks within their own groups, as well as relatively minor attacks on the state. Still, Brexit is having a destabilising effect, continues Bryan.
All of these groups will take advantage of periods when you can destabilise a place, and Brexit is very definitely destabilising it. I think the dissidents will probably try and do things at the border, try events. I suspect it would be very difficult for them to mount anything of any great note. But it all depends on whether we get a border and what that border looks like. That will make all the difference, and how it impacts people's lives. And that will change the political landscape.
The display you have here are belongings or items which were belong to the people who died on Bloody Sunday.
It's the final stop of Paul's tour, the Free Derry Museum, which shows the history of Irish nationalism and the civil rights movement in the Bogside. Inside a glass cabinet, dedicated to the victims of Bloody Sunday, is Paul's father's belt, alongside a life-size picture of his dad lying dead in the street. Paul explains the impact that the violent loss of a family member had on him and his five siblings.
As well, if you know what I mean, because it was a struggle every day, and he just learned to cope and he learned to get on with it. Then he become a teenager, and then he become 16 or 17, you grow into an adult, and your life just becomes what it is, you know. But you always have the memories and the regrets, and obviously of losing your dad in such circumstances, and you always have the regrets of your dad being missing at the table of weddings and christenings, and missed out, and certainly his children growing up and his grandchildren growing up as well.
Still, despite what he and his family went through, Paul talks proudly and positively about the Bogside and his native city.
We've settled in a peaceful city, a city which is really now attracting people from around the world as well, and really, really good today for the younger generations growing up. And you know, it's great to go into your pub with your daughter and have a beer and sort of listen to a bit of Irish music and have a chat and stuff like that. So, I mean, it is what it is. You know, before we did it, we always did that anyway, but you were doing it in the face of the possible explosion out in the street, or the explosion of the British Army in the pub to arrest people or to question people and stuff. So, I mean, it's a very peaceful city.
As Brexit creeps closer, he just hopes it won't threaten Derry's hard-won peace. Jennifer Collins and Louise Osborne for DW in Derry, Northern Ireland.
Your shortcut to globalisation and development stories. DW's radio weekly World in Progress brings you in-depth analysis and reports from around the globe. Just go to dw.com or subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes.
Brexit is, of course, not just impacting on the UK and its ties with the EU. It's also changing the lives of Brits living in Germany. Many have applied for German citizenship. But as an official who oversaw my own so-called Einbürgerung or naturalisation ceremony aptly said in his speech, we're not asking you to forget your old home country or the country of your parents. That will always be part of your identity and can only enrich your life as a German citizen. Luckily for all the Brits turned German, almost every German city has a so-called English shop that helps them connect with their old home by selling all those wonderful products you simply can't get in German supermarkets, for instance. For me, it's crumpets and pretty much all the ingredients of a proper English fry-up. But Brexit could have a major impact for those little British havens on German soil. In Berlin, for instance, Dale Carr is closing down her shop because of Brexit. My colleague Loveday Wright visited Dale in her shop Broken English in Berlin-Kreuzberg.
Walking into this small shop in Berlin's Kreuzberg district feels like stepping into England, an old, cosy version of it. The shelves are stocked with boxes of tea, jars of jam and marmalade, tins of golden syrup and bottles of English ale. But these products won't be here for much longer. In the face of Brexit chaos, owner Dale Carr has decided to close the shop. She says there'll be just a few more deliveries coming before the end of the month.
That should hopefully see us through till the end of April, May time, before we close at the end of May. And I'm hoping that will last, but it's been selling very fast lately because people are stocking up. They're doing their own stockpiling, you know, like in the UK, but it's over here. So,
yeah. So have people talked to you about that?
Of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah, they want their tea. You know, there's some things you can't live without, and salad cream for some reason. And, well, there's many things, brown sauce, vinegar. And those who have a deep freeze are stocking up on their bacon and sausages, huh?
Originally from the UK, Dale Carr has run the shop Broken English here in Berlin for 23 years. She and her husband have had a few shops in the city in that time, selling British food and gifts. They'd been thinking about retiring for a while, but Brexit has prompted them to make the move.
But we made our decision after the referendum. We already knew what would happen if they left. And so that's why we closed the first shop last May. And we made the decision to close this one this May. So I've now spent 2.5 years talking about Brexit and the consequences thereof and what it means for the business.
It means that importing British products is likely to become a lot more complicated.
And that is something I personally really wouldn't want to deal with. I don't like the form filling, wondering if some items won't be allowed in, which is very possible. It just will be completely different, and because it's completely different, I have no idea. There comes a point when you go, I really don't want to be doing that, and I wouldn't feel confident either. I mean, there hasn't been any information.
The uncertainty is a huge worry for Dale and her customers.
Last year, people were buying like 2 boxes of Christmas crackers so they could, you know, manage this one just in case, you know, because it's always like just in case, because we just don't know, which is really quite appalling when you think we're now into the middle of March and we just don't know. Not good for business, of course. Well, anybody's business. It's not good for that. You can't plan. I presume there's lots of people like me all over Europe with their little shops wondering if they can continue on, knowing if they're going to lose their livelihood. We count ourselves very fortunate because we've done it so long and we're so old, you know, so we can retire and just call it a day and not have to face it. So. But a lot of other people won't be in that position at all.
There is a potential buyer for the shop. Nothing's certain yet, but Dale's sure there's plenty of demand for products like hers.
I've collected addresses now since, I don't know, I think it's about 2 weeks now. We've just been collecting customers' addresses because I never did that. And we're now over 500 people who are going, oh, I do hope it carries on.
People want the things that remind them of home or of friends, a holiday, the familiar, the unusual. From mustard powder to marmalade mix to crumpets, bubbly discs of chewy dough to warm up and slather butter on. A Canadian customer comes rushing in looking for cream eggs, a British favourite, chocolate Easter eggs filled with a sticky fondant filling, complete with yellow yolk.
It's just childhood nostalgia springing forth. Yeah, I got my daughter into them as well, unfortunately, so every year she's asking for them, but it's mostly me.
Dale says they've got an order coming in ahead of what could be Brexit Day.
We'll try to get out of the country before the end of March.
Yeah. Very good idea. I should have ordered a box just for myself. Last year I didn't buy enough and I think I bought 16.
There are 6 boxes coming in.
Oh, good.
So if you get in first.
They last a couple of years, don't they?
He's not the only one with a special request. A young man from Edinburgh arrives, searching for a mysterious Scottish speciality.
So I believe in every country in the world, bar Scotland, Coca-Cola is the most popular soft drink, apart from Scotland, where it's Iron Brew, a strange orange drink which tastes like nothing else in the world. So I came here to try and find some.
But no luck today.
No luck today, but next week I'll be back for sure.
There you go.
Ah, there's... Oh, fantastic. Just my luck. Cool.
On the Dale's just found a can, orange can of Iron Brew, just one left.
This is what you call a hard sell, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
One Iron Brew. That's 1.35, please.
It's not long before Brexit comes up.
Thank you very much. We're still as in the dark about it as we were, you know, 2 years ago. Maybe there's hope for Scotland in some sort of way. What I'm hoping for is that we'll just kind of forget about it, that it'll that May will have, you know, she'll claim that she's used up all her you know, possible ideas and time, and we're just going to forget about it as though nothing happened. But but you know, one can only hope.
Woke up, it was a bad dream.
Yeah, it'll be a historic occasion, whatever the outcome is. Yeah, very frightening.
Dale Carr says her customers come from all over the world. Many of them are Germans with a taste for British foods.
I know the shop very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, 20 years? Scones, clotted cream, strawberry. Yeah, I love scones. Yeah. Yes. I tried to bake them by myself, but it wasn't so good. Yeah.
And what do you think about Brexit?
Oh, I hope that they will not have a Brexit. Don't like it. I'm a girl from the 60s. I love traveling to England too. And I not like this nationalism. That's it.
Dale Carr and her family have decided to take on German citizenship. That way they feel safe, she says. As for many Brits abroad, Britain's choice to leave the EU has changed her relationship with her home country.
I haven't been since the referendum, so I haven't set foot in the country since then.
Really? On purpose? Or?
Well, yes, I was so angry, you see. You know, I mean, you know, once the shock disappeared, a bit like the divorce situation, isn't it? Or grieving or something, you go through all these stages. And the anger was quite incredible, because I'm quite a bit of a softie, really. I don't really get angry, you know, but it was there. I was annoyed. I was very annoyed. And I thought, if I go back and actually meet a Leave voting person, I'd be staring at them all going, OK, which one of you did this to me and mine? And I know I would be looking like that. And of course, I'd be challenging them all. I think maybe that's my Germanness coming out. I don't just, you know, smile sweetly and ignore the topic. No.
Despite Dale's anger and the uncertainty she and her family have been battling, Dale says she still feels very British.
Well, you can't be anything than you are. You know, it's like when I've spoken to some people, they didn't want to do German nationality because they said, well, I'm British. I thought, well, yeah, well, you are. Nothing happens. It really doesn't. I'm proof of that. You don't wake up the next day, you know, sort of just wanted to eat currywurst or something. It doesn't happen. You are a mixture of everything. I mean, the longer you're away anywhere, you take on, hopefully, all the positive things of living somewhere else, just as the EU citizens who live in the UK have done. I mean, they've become Anglophile, Britishified, you know. They've become quite British because they live there. And this is the most amazing thing about the EU, I find. We all take on the good bits of wherever we're living.
Brexit might mean Dale's shop closing its doors, but it won't stop her customers hankering after their favourite products.
We know what you miss, don't we?
Yeah.
We know what you miss.
Yeah.
16,000 Brits live in the German capital, and however much we might feel at home, many of us will still be scouring the city for a tea bag we can trust, even if Brexit makes it harder to find. Loveday Wright for DW in Berlin.
You're listening to DW's World Link with me, Neil King. Stay with us.
Better than you. 1-1-0-1-1-1. Got it, decision problem, attention gone. Super task relations, generation seek. Yeah, hypercomputer, be my own private geek. Your independence depends on me. I am part of your family tree. Taylor Marx, Darwin meets machine face. The real world is a lonely place. When you watch computer, computer watching you. The more you watch computer, computer, computer watching you. Computer in love.
You're listening to DW's Worldlink, and I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. If you're into Fortnite, World of Warcraft, or Minecraft, our next report should interest you. If you've never heard these terms, but have teenage children who are glued to their keyboards all day and oblivious to all else, you could try breaking the spell by warning them that they are low on mana. You'll get an immediate reaction. I'm talking about computer games, which experts say are fueling gaming addiction in youngsters. According to a study by the German health insurer DRK, around 3 million youths aged 12 to 17 play computer games at least once a week. Around 12% of them are considered addicts. Over three quarters of them are boys. Better gaming than drugs, you might think. Sure, but gaming also has its risks. It can lead to growing isolation, depression, not to mention a string of ailments that come with a chronic lack of movement. But when does addiction start? Well, the experts say that if your avatar is more important than your own life, or if you would rather play video games than eat or shower, you're an addict. And what's more, you're in need of treatment. A clinic in the West German town of Gütersloh is offering just that. This report by Andreas Bücker is presented by Ineke Mules.
A clinic in Gütersloh at the Department of Media Dependence. Psychologist and therapist Christian Gross heads across the hall past a table tennis table.
For the patients, this is a place where they usually start to feel better again. The fact alone that they're with people who have similar problems helps them. They feel like they can open up here, which is often difficult to do outside these walls.
Christian Gross came here 4 years ago when the construction of one of Germany's first centres for video game addiction was just getting underway. Today, internet addicts from all over the country are being treated here at the Bernhard Salzmann Clinic.
Most of the patients here are very young people. Some are well-educated and very performance-oriented people who in reality have often fallen short of their own or others' expectations, or they have failed at something. It's like they're trying to still be successful at something else.
The 36-year-old psychologist has tattoos, piercings, and wears a brightly coloured cap. Visually, at least, he doesn't look all that different from his patients, which he says is an advantage.
People here start talking to each other on the same level very quickly. This is good for the therapy process because trust can arise and a therapeutic relationship with a patient can also be effective.
In the ward kitchen, five young men sit together eating lunch, which they cook together. They've all been undergoing inpatient therapy for the past few months after having been immersed in the digital world for years. 40-year-old Murat is the oldest patient in the ward. He says he lost himself in a sort of parallel world. In order to reach higher levels in the game, he played more and more so that his avatar, the digital figure which he embodied in the virtual world, would continue to get new tools or weapons.
You control your avatar, and it has an ability to do certain things. It'll have, like, an axe to chop down trees. So you just go over to the trees and chop them down by clicking them with the mouse.
So Murad clicked and clicked and clicked, cutting down virtual trees all day long. He didn't care about the real world anymore. He just chopped wood, which he planned to build a ship with. All the while, he was talking to other players in the game through his headset, who were also sat in front of their computers all over the world.
I chopped wood for 16 hours at a time every day for 8 days in a single game.
Murad's therapist, Christian, finds it fascinating to see how much influence the computer games have on the personality development of his patients.
It's really exciting to observe the gamers while they're playing the game. If they're sitting here in front of me during a therapy session, they seem depressed or socially anxious. But when they enter the game, they're suddenly much more social and are bossing around other people. They're often know-it-alls, almost narcissistic. So you get two completely different personalities.
For years, video games have been one of the most popular free time activities in Germany. And it's no longer simply animated sport games. The internet has paved way for the development of complex role-playing games which allow thousands of people to participate, especially boys and men. Girls and women make up only about one-fifth of the online gamer population. From a neurobiological perspective, excessive time spent playing video games triggers the same process as any other addiction would. For example, scientists have studied which parts of the brain are stimulated when an alcoholic looks at a photograph of a glass of beer or hears the hissing noise of a bottle being opened. These responses in the brain are almost identical to those of a video game addict when he looks at a screenshot of his favourite game or listens to the opening theme music. Even so, most people who spend an excessive amount of time playing games in front of the screen deny that they are addicted.
So what do patients say about the motivation behind their behavior? I'm very performance-oriented. It's all about being successful. But if you ask them about their implicit motives, it's actually far more likely that they long for love, affection, commitment, reliability. Actually, they are lonely people.
Not everybody who enjoys playing online games becomes addicted. Most people can control their behaviour. But if someone starts to withdraw from everyday life and retreat into a virtual gaming world, it's a sign he may be heading towards an addiction. In these cases, the game starts to become more important than other everyday needs, such as regular meals or personal hygiene. Professional or academic obligations begin to fall by the wayside. The World Health Organization recently added gaming disorder to its international classification of diseases. Scientists from various disciplines participated in the debate, including behavioral psychologist Stefan Pitten from Cologne. He enjoys playing video games himself, but he is aware of the risks.
Our reward system is massively stimulated by this type of media content. Our brain learns, oh yes, this is great, I'll start investing in this and spend more time here. But then the things that once felt really rewarding are increasingly perceived as less rewarding.
More and more people are relocating entertainment, fun, new experiences, and even forming personal relationships on the internet. But it can turn into a trap which they can't escape from.
In
extreme cases, of course, a parallel world can emerge, which sometimes determines the thinking, the behavior, and the feelings of the person who is inside it. Their grip on reality begins to slip. It can be psychosomatic, and then that reality is increasingly misunderstood and eventually no longer deciphered.
Although gamers can spend days sitting alone in front of the screen, this does not mean they feel lonely. For many years, 33-year-old Pascal, who is now a patient at Gütersloh, found it easier to socialise in the virtual world compared to real life.
When I played World of Warcraft, we were a relatively big community. At the beginning, we had almost over 50 people. We were organized into different structures, kind of like a sports club.
That's a World of Warcraft, yeah.
The interactive role-playing game World of Warcraft was released in Germany in 2005. Since then, the clinic's director of therapy, Ulrike Dickenhorst, has observed with concern how online-based role-playing games have helped to multiply the number of video game addicts.
We've been treating addicts for many years. By 2010, we realized we had a lot of patients who spent a lot of time in front of the computer playing World of Warcraft or first-person shooter games. These people experience feelings of belonging, a sense of security, and develop new skills. They develop a new behavior which they can no longer distance themselves from.
Unlike other addicts, video game addicts are largely invisible to society. In Germany, experts estimate that over 1 million people are dependent on digital media.
Unfortunately, there's an increasing thought pattern emerging along the lines of, I have less success in real life and more success in the real world. This creates an imbalance which causes them to move further and further away from the real world. It also lessens their ability to cope with frustration and challenges in everyday life.
Psychologists speak of a double identity. Many video game addicts consider themselves to be unpopular, unattractive, and even failures. In the virtual world, however, they see themselves as successful, popular, important, and respected. But does this positive self-image in cyberspace also have an impact in the real world? Murat isn't so sure.
It's crazy that you could spend so much time there, and in the end you have a certain amount of success because you've achieved a lot. So you look back and think, okay, this is fine, but in reality you have nothing. If you could only turn that energy into reality.
Wenn man die Energie mal in die Realität umsetzen würde.
The first few weeks of therapy were tough for Murat. Suddenly, he had no access to his virtual world. After being cut off from cyberspace, some video game addicts feel as though they have lost their identity. This is one key difference compared to other forms of addiction. There are still very few therapists who have experience dealing with this situation. Youth psychologist Ulrike Dickenhorst and her team in Gütersloh are pioneers in the field.
We come into play if we assume the patient has a dependency disease. For example, if they fulfill certain addiction criteria, such as spending more than 30 hours a week outside of school or work playing online games. The treatment approaches need to be very concrete, professional and evidence-based.
At the clinic, Murat has discovered a new game, billiards. He also wants to start focusing more on his future, offline.
Das ist mein Ziel. Deswegen bin ich hier.
That's my goal. That's why I'm here, so I can lead a stable life again. It doesn't have to be thrilling. I don't need to get rich quick or begin a career. For me, the main thing is to have stability, balance and joy in life again.
Und wieder Freude am Leben.
That report by Andreas Bucher was presented by Ineke Mules. Time for a music break before we take you to what's probably America's most iconic island and on the bucket list of pretty much any tourist visiting the East Coast. Take a tiny island, a French woman, a good dose of symbolism, et voilà, you have a national memorial. In 2016, 4.5 million visitors made the trip to Liberty Island at the gates of New York City. Following its closure in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and repairs after Hurricane Sandy in 2012, the promenade and the Statue of Liberty were reopened to the public in 2013. Michael Marek met park historian Barry Moreno to find out about the history of the place. His report is presented by Loveday Wright.
Welcome to the symbol of freedom.
A park ranger invites visitors to take in the view. Before them is the Hudson River, populated with colourful ferries and the skyline of downtown Manhattan. 93 metres below, hundreds of people mill about on the red brick island promenade.
Right now we're standing in the Statue of Liberty's head, and so her face is just below us, just slightly here. Just her nose is within view here. As we look down from her, we're the crown, they call it the crown. So we can see through these 25 windows. The windows represent the gems of a crown. And then above these windows is the statues. We can see, of course, the bottom of the torch to the right.
Wow. Historian Barry Moreno works for the New York City National Park Service. He's a veritable authority on the history of Liberty Island Promenade and the 132-year-old French figure who towers above it. In her 13-metre-long right arm, Lady Liberty gracefully holds the torch of freedom into the American sky. The mayors of New York might come and go, but the statue that was inaugurated in 1886 was built for an eternity.
And the Americans started to see her as a symbol of American perfection, in terms of democracy, being superior to everybody else in the world, the most free country in the world, and also nobility of the American people, the idea that the Americans have a unique form of government, and they were a unique people. And also that American nationalism eventually begins to emerge as American nationalism, a defense against, especially with the rise of Mussolini in 1922 and his successors, I mean, his Herr Hitler, Lenin and Stalin and so these dictators. As more of Europe became more under authoritarian governments and Japan became very militaristic as too in Asia, the Americans began to see her as a symbol against totalitarianism, against especially fascism first, and also other authoritarianism, and then later against communism, Bolshevism, and so forth. And then especially of anti-communism in this red period.
Barry Moreno speaks about the arrogance and selective memory of fellow Americans with a fine sense of irony. He is eloquent and fires his words like ammunition at ignorance. The exploitation of Lady Liberty is a thorn in his side, no matter what form it takes, and the list is long.
It's a continuation, though. Probably intensifies, because September 11th, 2001, catastrophe and crime, outrage, did a lot to enhance the importance of the statue once again. Because, you know, there have been other catastrophes. Pearl Harbor was attacked in 1941. The war in Europe, the liberation of Europe, the D-Day invasion, all of these events, the war with Japan and all the men that were killed and all the people in Europe were killed and displaced and, you know, just rebuilding the world. So the renewal. So the Statue of Liberty was very deeply emotionally symbolic then, but probably even maybe more as years have gone by, because the Statue of Liberty has transformed into a universal symbol, which wasn't really before. From French-American to American nationalism to American freedom and defense to universal worldwide celebration and recognition, which is amazing.
More than 4.5 million tourists flock to Liberty Island annually. They come by ferry for the 10-minute stroll around the promenade. There are no cars here.
New York, New York's a hell of a town. The Bronx is up and the Battery's down, and the people ride in the hole in the ground. New York, New York,
It's a hell of a town.
And here liberty is attached to free enterprise. Although entry to the island and the promenade is free, the ferry from the southern tip of Manhattan is not. And the only ones who get to climb up to the good lady's crown are those who book to do so months in advance.
We only see 365 people each day. We limit it due to heat and due to we don't have any emergencies up here. In the past, we used to have lines 2-3 hours waiting. Now, we take a little more common sense with that. I'm not here the whole day. I'm here a couple hours, and then I go to another post, and someone else comes up here. But this is the happiest place on the island.
Dave McCutcheon is part of the security team at Liberty Island.
Where are you from, young lady? Hey.
The idea to build a promenade complete with a symbolic female figure on the tiny island came from French historian, republican and anti-royalist Édouard de La Boulaye. It was intended to reaffirm the alliance between France and the US and their similar constitutions, both promoting freedom and world enlightenment. But that's one of the stories that few have heard about, explains historian Barry Moreno.
A lot of them don't know that the statue was promoted by the Freemasons. They don't know the Masonic connection because it was a secret society. And other things is that people think it was built for immigrants, to receive immigrants. And that's not true. The Statue of Liberty has nothing to do with, originally had nothing to do with immigrants. It was not designed for immigrants. It was also, some people think it was designed to pay tribute to the end of slavery in America. And even though there's a slight relationship, it's not really, that was not its purpose either. It had nothing to do with the freeing of African Americans as slaves, not at all. Many people don't realize that it was the largest man-made structure in New York when it was built. Also, it's the largest statue ever built in the United States, even up to now. Some people think the statue was built as a gift to New York. And of course, and that it's a symbol of New York. The Statue of Liberty is not a symbol of New York, and it was not given to New York. It was given to the people of the United States.
In 1865, the French liberals and their leader, de La Boulaye, decided to honour the idea of liberty with a symbolic gift to the United States, thereby protesting the policies of Napoleon III and his repressive state. It was the perfect time. The American Civil War between the northern and southern states had just ended, slavery had been abolished, and the 100th birthday of the young American nation was imminent. The first idea was to present the US with a gold commemorative coin, but that quickly evolved into thoughts of a huge monument of copper and steel. The idea for the Statue of Liberty had been born. Sculptor Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi from Colmar in the French region of Alsace was commissioned to create the statue, a modern-day colossus of Rhodes. The face of the resulting 46-metre-tall statue is said to be modelled on that of Bartholdi's single mother, and her body on that of his lover.
It's nice to put stuff together and mix
up. Yeah, that's great.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your life.
In 1886, the finished statue was finally erected on the far side of the Atlantic. There was initially little enthusiasm for the French gift, and Congress said it would only cover maintenance costs if the statue made itself useful, serving as a lighthouse, for example.
So the statue was at night, though she was not well lighted. There was no flood lighting system, so she was rather dark. The torchlight was burning, though, the electric lights, light bulbs, but it wasn't a very strong light. And the American government had accepted the statue as not only just a gift from the French people, but also to be a lighthouse, the first electrical lighthouse in America. So she was, for about 16 years, used as a lighthouse. It wasn't very effective for navigation, though, because the light was never strong enough for ships at night or in fog. And so the statue was discontinued as a lighthouse in 1902. And in the meanwhile, the army, this was an army base, so there was a fort here. with American soldiers. And so there was a combination of tourists coming to see the Goddess of Liberty, and then there were also these, a military base.
Moreno says the reason France gave the US the statue was because there was so little freedom in Europe at the time, and the French anti-royalist political agenda was all about the New World. The country's liberals made a generous contribution to the cost of the statue, which proved easy to raise. In the US, however, donations for the construction of the pedestal were slow in coming. The economic beneficiaries of the country's newfound freedom, the wealthy, the manufacturers and entrepreneurs, were especially stingy. Then Joseph Pulitzer, a Civil War veteran and a successful newspaper owner, decided to take up the cause, declaring the Statue of Liberty a national issue. A good chunk of the funding ultimately came from the Freemasons, who still hold their ceremonies in front of the statue. In the immediate aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks in 2001, Liberty Island was closed to visitors. Although the island was allowed to reopen a few weeks later, the giant green lady remained a no-go area to the public for years, until 2009, when tourists were finally allowed back into the statue. But after only 2 years, it was closed for restoration and repair work. A day after it was reopened in October 2012, Hurricane Sandy swept in and destroyed parts of the promenade and the docks, putting them off limits to the public for almost another year. On the 4th of July 2013, the restrictions were lifted, and the sites have been accessible to the public ever since.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above.
Dominic Chianese, the actor from the US television series The Sopranos, sang at the opening ceremony.
To the oceans white with foam, God bless America, my home, sweet home.
Today, the 93-metre-high tourist attraction is fireproof and bombproof. A new elevator has been installed inside the statue, and tourists visiting the museum in the pedestal pass through state-of-the-art security gates. But it's worth it, according to former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who promised an exciting experience for every visitor.
They've produced a whole new, exciting experience for you. Look at the remarkable interior structure of the statue.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
Today, visitors can climb as high as Lady Liberty's crown. The torch has been off limits to the general public since sustained damage during a nearby munitions explosion in 1916. But Lady Liberty's light of freedom will never go out, said former New York Governor George Pataki in his patriotic speech.
For the people of New York, the people of America, and the people of the world, it never diminished. It never went out. It never will.
The statue's external appearance has been preserved since its inauguration in 1886. Only its symbolism has changed over the years.
After some years, the Americans began to assimilate the statue, to make her into American culture, to Americanize her. So the French goddess became more and more an American.
We're really saying to the rest of the world, this is America, and Americans are strong, and Americans value their freedoms.
Such sentiment is typical of the United States, notes Moreno.
It was a hollow icon because the statue was hollow inside. But this hollowness also was symbolic. That people can put their own dreams inside of the statue and make her represent themselves with their ideas. And that's amazing because this means the statue has been can be used by conservatives, by liberals, by radicals, by all sorts of people of all persuasions, political and cultural and societal persuasions, and used also commercially for business and enterprise.
Right, give me a good Christmas day.
And it's been an extremely successful venture. Complete and utter commercialization has nearly buried any memory of the monument's original historical message. And is it even still valid today? A fast food restaurant, a museum shop, and a souvenir stand with cheap t-shirts, coffee cups, plastic statue replicas, American flags, and other patriotic paraphernalia are a must for many tourists. As is the selfie with Lady Liberty herself.
That report by Michael Marek was presented by my colleague Loveday Wright. And that wraps up this week's edition of Worldlink. We hope you will join us again next week. In the meantime, you can download this and other DW programs in our DW Media Center. Or, even better, get our free weekly Worldlink podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. This week's edition was produced by Loveday Wright and me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Michael Springer. Bye for now. Worldlink is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.